Do you still bet the horse races?
That's the only thing now?
Uh-huh.
I don't bet anything. Now I'm afraid I'll win, and then they'll say I made more money than I did.
You mean you just don't want to win anymore?
I don't want any more.
So it was that Senator Estes Kefauver encountered a satisfied horse player by the name of Virginia Hill Hauser.
This is Voices and Events, the program that covers the world to bring the voices and sounds in the news of the past 7 days. Tonight, an on-the-scene report of St. Patrick's Day in Dublin. General MacArthur from Korea, Winston Churchill from London, and the sound and fury in Foley Square as the Senate crime busters came to New York. Living history presented through new techniques of reporting and recording pioneered by NBC. Now, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
From Monday on in New York City, everyone stayed home or visited his favorite pub to hear the big show starring Senators Kefauver, Toby, and O'Connor, the Senate Crime Investigators. We interviewed the man in the bar to measure some public reaction to these proceedings.
Look, tell me, what do you think about this gammon investigation?
Well, now I'll tell you. I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me.
That may come to be known as the $64 answer. It turned up frequently during the week, first from big-time bookmaker Frank Erickson, who left a jail cell to say,
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me.
Was it $169,000? 1948?
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me.
Erickson, round-faced cherubic, was followed on the stand by dapper Joe Adonis, allegedly a top power of the underworld. Adonis, too, sang that old refrain.
I decline to answer that question, Senator, on the grounds it might tend to incriminate me.
Mr. Adonis, were you ever partner or have any interest in the Piping Rock Casino at Saratoga?
I decline to answer that question, Senator, on the grounds it might tend to incriminate me.
The senators have recommended contempt citations for both Adonis and Erickson. That distinction was soon to be shared by an ex-bootlegger and prominent gambler and politician by name Frank Costello. He suffered from the most publicized laryngitis of the week.
Do you still have the strong box?
Yes.
How much cash do you have in it today?
I wouldn't know.
Do you have over $1,000 in it?
I imagine I have.
Do you have over $10,000 in
it? I wouldn't know.
Is it possible that you have over $10,000 in it?
I wouldn't know.
Why wouldn't you know how much cash you have in your strongbox?
Because I have no occasion to look.
What?
It turned out that Frank Costello had about $50,000 in this cookie jar in his apartment, and the senators were incredulous. The man who asked those persistent questions was Rudolph Halley, chief counsel for the crime committee. Through the week, Mr. Halley attempted, to the distress of publicity-shy politicians, to show that Frank Costello had the closest relations with Tammany Hall. The man who testified to that effect was a Republican named Charles Lipsky. Lipsky recalled that ex-Mayor O'Dwyer, who'll testify tomorrow, had resolved to reform Tammany.
Well, did he do anything about it after he was elected?
Yes.
What did he do?
Called me up and asked me to come in to see him.
When was this? Can you place the time?
Well, it was in 46. The weather was a little warm. I remember that. And I went to see him.
And he told you he would like you to go see those boys in the Copacabana?
That's right.
Go ahead, please.
And give them the message that I want them to supplant the leader of Tammany Hall and also to revoke the rule of the synthetic votes.
And who did you find in the Copacabana?
Well, I was told to go. When he said the boys, he says, now I want you to dig up that fella Clary Neal and deliver this order to him.
You mean Clarence Neal?
Yes. And I approached him and delivered the message that the mayor told me to deliver.
To Neal?
Clary Neal, yeah.
Now, was there anybody else present when you delivered that message to Neal?
Oh, there was quite a number of people in the place. Quite
well,
a number.
Was there anybody with Neal and with you?
Well, when I delivered the message quietly to Neal, he called over two or three people to listen to him.
And who were the people he called?
I think Judge Mancuso was one.
Francis Mancuso?
Yeah. And sitting right nearby this table was Frank Costello.
And was he one of the people who listened to you?
Well, he repeated which of those two, what I had conveyed to him.
I mean, Neil repeated to Mancuso and Costello what you had said to Neil.
Yeah.
Did you receive any reply to your message?
Well, Mr. Neil was very indignant about it and used language a little rough.
In effect, he said no.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. I delivered the reply to the mayor, and he said, all right, we starved them out. That's the last. It was.
He said, all right, what?
We starved them out.
Well, Mr. Lipsky, I still don't understand why you would be the emissary of Mayor O'Dwyer to see these people up at...
Well, we were very friendly.
I know, but why wouldn't he go himself instead of sending you?
Well, go up himself and tell a fellow who's the leader who directly made him mayor to get out?
Mm-hmm. I still don't understand also why you would be so interested in picking Mr. Quayle or anyone else to be...
Very popular.
...being mayor, but you're a Republican, and...
But you can't elect a Republican in Greater New York as mayor.
So you just join the...
Get the best you can get on the other side.
I see. So it's sort of a nonpartisan effort or a bipartisan effort.
Correct.
Is that the situation? What do you do now, sir?
Retired.
Mr. Lipsky, the Republican who did the best he could among New York's Democrats, was one of the few witnesses to offer hard facts to the committee. On the evasive side, there was, for example, a Mrs. Hauser, better known as Virginia Hill, girlfriend of the murdered Bugsy Siegel. Her wealth, she revealed, came from an uncanny ability to pick winning horses, about which she received advance information from apparently reliable sources.
Do you still bet the horse races?
That's the only thing now?
Uh-huh.
I don't bet anything. Now I'm afraid I'll win, and then they'll say I made more money than I did.
You mean you just don't want to win anymore?
I don't want any more.
Well, that's a good reformation, all right.
You've testified now about a lot of the details of your own finances and your own business. But are you really not in any position to give this committee any of the details you must have heard about the business of Siegel or Adonis?
But I never knew anything about their business. They didn't tell me about their business. Why would they tell me? I don't care anything about business in the first place.
The reason
I
ask
understand
is that you seem to have a great deal of ability to handle financial affairs.
Who, me?
You seem to have taken very good care of your own finances.
I take care of myself, but...
And frankly, it's hard for me to believe, sitting here watching you... in the last half
hour. Well, whether you believe it or not, I didn't know anything about their business. I wasn't interested. And in the first place, if they ever started talking to people, I left because I didn't want to know.
It just seems impossible that
you wouldn't know who their associates
were.
Well, maybe it's impossible, but
it's true. You just didn't want to know.
No, I didn't want to know anything about anybody.
Thank you.
Mrs. Hauser, did you go to Italy when you were in Europe?
I was never in Italy in my life. Only Lee Mortimer had me there. With two children that I can't find. I'm supposed to have two grown children. He had me there twice. I've never been to Italy in my life, and I've never met Luciano or seen him or anything.
Well, he had you there, all right.
Well, he had me there twice. He had even a woman. They found and said it was me. He had her picture in the paper with two kids.
But that wasn't you.
Well, it certainly wasn't. I was in Mexico, even when I came across the immigration lab. Says, you're supposed to be in Italy. I said, well, you see where I am. They said, well, they got to write about something.
So you didn't know Lucky Luciano?
Well, I never saw the man in my life or been near him or anything. Know nothing about him.
Who do you know in St. Louis, well?
Well, some of the people are not people that you would be interested in that I wouldn't care to
tell us some of the people we'd be interested in, you know.
Well, I don't think you'd be interested in many of them. Swifty was there when I was there, so I went to see him.
All right. Anything else?
Nothing more.
Thank you very much.
Is that all?
That's all. Go back home.
A small hand for Mrs. Hauser. All this was going on before radio microphones and television cameras. However, when Frank Costello testified, he was kept out of camera range, though for a time his nervous fingers were on view. But as the week wore on, the public was denied a view of any part of Frank Costello. And his laryngitis, in the view of his attorney, was enough to challenge a six-way cold tablet. By Thursday, Frank Costello was resolved to get away from it all.
You heard my statement through Mr. Wolf, and I stand by it, and under no condition will I testify from herein until I'm well enough.
You refuse to testify further?
Absolutely. Mr. Halley, am I a defendant in this courtroom?
No.
Am I under arrest?
No.
Proceed, Mr. Halley.
Mr. Costello, did you hear the testimony of Mr. Francis McLaughlin yesterday?
Now, the defense
of
the...
Mr. Halley, all due respect for the Senate, which I have an awful lot of respect for, I'm not going to answer another question. You just says I'm not under arrest and I'm going to walk out.
But I want you to understand, if you're contemplating walking out, as you've just put it, or any such act, that this committee is not powerless. The United States Senate has the power to order you arrested and brought physically before the committee to testify. Now, if you're ill, produce a doctor's certificate. Produce an affidavit of a doctor. If you're not ill, testify.
I'm submitting a certificate of a doctor who examined Mr. Costello this morning.
Well, this doesn't say, Mr. Wolf, that dangerous or injurious to Mr. Costello's health for him to testify. Is it just a sore throat? Is that his difficulty? Or?
I don't know.
He seems to be able to talk very well.
I think it's his gallbladder.
Senator Tobey's knowledge of Latin probably would help us know what those terms are. I don't know.
Would you state whether or not you are familiar with the testimony given yesterday by Mr. Francis McLaughlin?
I refuse to answer the question. When the proper time comes, I'll have plenty to say.
The committee tried again on Friday, but Costello's rasping vocal cords were apparently reduced to a squeak. He wasn't going to talk.
I don't care to answer any questions, Mr. Senator.
Well, it's not a matter of whether you care to answer them, Mr. Costello.
I don't
it's
feel
a matter
unfit.
Of,
I don't feel I'm fit to answer any questions today. And answer them truthfully and sensible.
What was the last question?
Do you know Mr. James Moran?
I'm not going to answer the question today.
Do you know Mr. Frank Balls?
I'm not going to answer the question today.
Well, you understand you're being directed to answer these questions.
And I'm answering them.
Well, there's no use of continuing on if he's not going to answer them. You've
I'd just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that all those questions call for a yes or no answer, one word or one syllable. Yet he used eight words or two-syllable words to make us surprise he wouldn't testify.
So it was that Frank Costello won his recommendation for contempt. A committee physician was designated to investigate the laryngitis and pronounce Costello able to testify. Many other witnesses and subjects came to the senator's attention this week. Gambling at Saratoga, alleged payoffs in high places. As he listened to these stories of the seamy side of American life, Senator Tobey of New Hampshire was moved to righteous indignation.
Well, up in New England, we had a poet years ago. He's now dead. His name is John Greenleaf Whittier. And he had a summer home up in Squam Lake in Holderness, New Hampshire. He was a great man. He was a bachelor all his life. He wrote some wonderful things in poetry. But he wrote one poem called Problems. And in this poem, he recounted all the ills of the body parting his day. And he closed with this couplet that I submit to the record here and to the people before me and over the radio and television. But solution there is none, save in the rule of Christ alone. There's the answer. When the hearts of men and women are touched, you take their inspiration from the master of men, then we'll have a righteous America and a new America. And make of this nation a nation wherein dwelleth righteousness. And before God, it's high time.
And editorialists who said amen to Senator Tobey's earnest statement were wondering, too, what would come of all this sound and fury. In 2 weeks, the crime committee will cease to exist. Will its work add up to more than just sensational publicity? That, as so often is the case, will probably be up to the American citizen. He had a lot of other things on his mind, though, including a war in Korea.
Bless them all, bless them all, bless the long and the short and the tall, Bless all the writers and columnists too, with the frontline exclusives from back in Taegu, while the photox with camera is wet, all dirty and covered with sweat. Are there when it happens, get hell for no captions, no bylines or bonuses yet.
Those singers are press photographers in Korea, griping about their colleagues with typewriters. Again this week, it was a war of maneuver. Important advances by U.N. forces, the recapture of Seoul. General Matt Ridgway, commander of the 8th Army, told us how he felt about it.
I think of a line of, in all the time, at least so far as I have any privilege to participate in this thing, a line of Kipling's, if you can fill each unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, will the 8th Army and its magnificent supporting services and allies plans to do just that. So long as we're on this peninsula, to fill each unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, and the fellas that'll run will be the Chinese.
And General MacArthur paid another whirlwind visit to the front. Last week, he'd given this personal appraisal of the situation.
Our strategic plan, involving constant movement to keep the enemy off balance, with a corresponding limitation upon his initiative, remains unaltered. There has been a resultant, continuing, and exhausting attrition upon both his manpower and supplies. There should be no illusions in this matter, however. In such a campaign of maneuver, as our battle lines shift north, the supply position of the enemy will progressively improve, just as inversely, the effectiveness of our air potential will progressively diminish. Assuming no diminution of the enemy's flow of ground forces and material to the Korean battle area, a continuation of the existing limitation upon our freedom of counteroffensive action, and no major additions to our organizational strength, the battle lines cannot fail in time to reach a point of theoretical military stalemate. Thereafter, our further advance would militarily benefit the enemy more than it would ourselves.
So, for the present, we would go so far, no farther. You've heard the voice of General MacArthur many times on this program, always speaking in rather formal style. This week, we were able to eavesdrop on the general as he talked off the cuff with a jet pilot, Colonel Thurman Schmidt of Arcadia, California. This is a more human MacArthur, greatly interested in the tactical problems of the jet plane and recalling an experience of the earlier war in the Pacific.
I remember when Lindbergh came out here. Do you remember that, when he was trying to increase the range?
Yes, he did well at it, too.
That was really that is the range that you can make an amphibious or a ground operation. You know, it's just the range that you can cover with your air.
Precisely.
So as you increase this, of course, you increase the whole potential war.
Exactly.
Have you been flying this yourself?
Yes, sir.
I see your name up on it.
My name is Schmidt, sir.
Yeah.
Carey is one of our squadron commanders who's just been promoted to deputy group now.
What's the cost of this plane?
$286,000.
$286,000. That's a right expensive toy when you smash up, isn't it? Huh?
I think the cost would go down, General, and produce many of them.
Uh-huh. And what is the operation cost? How much gasoline do you burn?
Well, sir, we'll run about 500 gallons per mission. 500 gallons per mission.
Yes, that isn't very much more than the others, is it?
No, sir, it's roughly the same as other jets.
What does a big bomber go on an average mission of 1,000 miles out and back? What does it do?
They burn
many times that.
3,000, 4,000 gallons.
Yeah, sure. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir.
In the air, on land and sea, the war went on. We were getting very close to the 38th parallel, and again, important decisions to be made, military and political. At Key West, Florida, President Truman was getting a fill-in on Korea from his intelligence advisor, Admiral Sowers, and the chief executive's vacation was near an end. He'd be back in Washington on Thursday. In Key West, the president carries on business with his congressional leaders via telephone. Press Secretary Joe Short this week described one such conversation.
The whole field was covered in this 15 to 20 minute telephone conversation which began at 11 a.m. Among the subjects discussed were the manpower bill pending in the House, the subject of troops to Europe, grain for India.
And back in Washington, the president would face the continuing problems of economic mobilization with labor still off the team, as well as persistent attacks on certain members of his official family, all of whom Mr. Truman announced to the press were honorable men. And there were plenty of diplomatic tangles. In Paris, the Russians seemed no nearer to agreement on that agenda for the Big Four conference. It was a difficult week for any chief of state. Last night in London, Winston Churchill called this a crucial time in world history. Mr. Churchill wants to be chief of state again, was making a new bid to return to power.
My friends, our country is in a position of danger and perplexity. Abroad, things are bad, and we are becoming ever more divided at home. At a time when it would take our whole genius and united strength to cope with our troubles and ward off our perils, we are more sharply and evenly separated than I can remember in a long life. In critical and baffling situations, it is always best to recur to first principles and simple action. Trust the people. Go to the people. Let the people have their say. Let there be a general election where they can express their will. Where they can express their will through a parliament worthy of what is strongest and best in our race. It is for this that we are resolved to strive. Good night.
You are listening to Voices and Events, NBC's living record of history. These are the actual voices of the people who made the news gathered by NBC correspondents all over the world. They've been reporting and recording events as they happen, gathering this first-hand account of the never-ending story that is the news. Again, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
In a week of crime and punishment, war and threats of war, there was one reassuring story. From Dublin to Timbuktu, the 17th of March was still St. Patrick's Day. This is yesterday's big parade down Fifth Avenue in New York City, where the very center stripe of the pavement was painted a triumphant green. The first St. Patrick's Day in Manhattan took place, with the consent of some friendly Indians, in 1762, or so they say. And through the years, the celebration's gone on. Let's go back to a merry gathering of the friendly sons of St. Patrick on March 17, 1936. The speaker of the evening was the former governor of New York, the one and only Al Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I read in the paper the other day that some man, I can't think of the name, said that ham and cabbage was not an Irish dish. Well, let's concede it. We've had our annual speech tonight, and if you notice, by the way, before I get too far into this, look on the program, there's no subject attached to me. And there's a very good reason for it. Because I've spoken to about everything that you can speak to from this platform in the last 20 years. And it's hard to find a new one for me, so I'm just among those present. And the other speakers were, see? But we can talk about the celebration of St. Patrick's Day and all that it means. And we can speak about the parade, and incidentally, let me leave this thought with you. The parade today was as good a one as I ever saw.
And yesterday, as in 1936, it was a great parade. As for St. Patrick himself, well, he was born, so they say, in the year 367. And of all things, in Scotland. But he went on to County Antrim as a shepherd boy, toiled for 33 years to convert the pagans, drive out the snakes. When the present-day foreign minister of Éire, Sean McBride, spoke to the National Press Club this week, he wasn't asked about the snakes, but there was a query about Reds in Ireland as follows.
Mr. Minister, we have a number of questions here. Some of them, I'm afraid, are loaded. Is there much of a communist problem in Ireland?
No, there's no communist problem in Ireland. There is a small communist party in Belfast. There is no communist party in the rest of Ireland. There are a few radicals, but there is no communist problem as such.
This man wants to know, who is Sean Nolan, the newspaper man who writes from Dublin for the Daily Worker? Do you know him, the gentleman?
Yes, he would be the nearest thing to a communist in Dublin. I think he spends most of his time with the Communist Party in Belfast. He may run down to Dublin again.
One final question, Mr. Minister. Are there as many Irishmen in Ireland as there are in the United States? And are they all in politics?
No. Because there are more Irishmen outside Ireland than in Ireland itself. There are quite a number in politics in Ireland, too.
Thank you very much, Mr.
The ambition of Sean McBride and his government is to bring the six northern counties of Ireland into the Republic. The ambition of the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, Sir Basil Brooke, is to maintain the status quo. Sir Basil had a bad time of it about a year ago when he was accused of banning St. Patrick's Day parades in Northern Ireland. We then put the question to the Prime Minister. Was it true that he had issued such a ban?
No, entirely untrue. There was one out of about a dozen parades which was banned because of possibility of disturbance. And the first duty of a government is to see that law and order is maintained. I actually passed myself through a parade near my own home. This is pure exaggeration and is a bit of propaganda. That's all I need to say about it.
Then we may take it, Sir Basil, that you are favorably disposed towards St. Patrick?
Oh, yes. He's an Ulsterman.
St. Patrick, an Ulsterman. Now, there's something that could start an argument, particularly in Dublin. And now, in an on-the-scene report, we bring you part of yesterday's celebration in the capital city of Éire. This is St. Patrick's Day in Dublin.
The crowd seemed happy and satisfied with this year's St. Patrick's Day industrial parade in Dublin. And so we say goodbye to our friends at home and abroad on this St. Patrick's Day. Yeshin Pogany Plonak Spanak Sekogodi Digi Logostyle. That ye of a Kutuk Father got a glare.
And that's how it was in Dublin, Ireland, yesterday, the 17th of March.
You have been listening to Voices and Events, the sounds of history in our time. James Fleming is the editor and narrator. The week's living history with the sounds and voices in the news is made possible through new techniques of reporting and recording pioneered by the NBC newsroom. This is Robert Warren inviting you to listen next week at this same hour when the NBC News and Special Events Department brings you the never-ending story that is the news on Voices and Events.
This program has come to you from our Radio City studios in New York. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.